Well, one thing occurred to me this week that in a rather resounding way, a substantial proportion of our country's people decided we need something different. A similarly sized proportion of our population said that may be true, but maybe not that different. So we've got some change coming. So I was wondering this week what there might be in our faith and in our scriptures that speaks to times of change that are deeply desired and yet we face with some anxiety, trepidation. So I thought of a particular passage in the New Testament, one of the few, I think, that if I were to give you the chapter and verse, and I will in a second, you'll more or less know what that is, that we have all heard many, many times, and that I suspect we might even be able to recite all or most of it from memory, about things that do not change, about what in fact abides. This from 1 Corinthians 13. Paul shows us and talks about what he calls a more excellent way. And I'm going to read this sort of in sections with a little bit of review and comment as we go forward. St. Paul writes, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing." So in other words, so far, if I am at my very best doing my most powerful things, but have not love, it doesn't much matter. Now there's another couple of verses here that talk about what love is, and more profoundly, what love isn't. And as I read these verses and you hear the word love, I'm going to pause for just a second. And after you hear the word love, say to yourself, politics. And we'll see where it goes for just a second or two. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. Love is not arrogant or rude. Love is not irritable or resentful. Now, I'm sure we have all heard all of the arrogance, rudeness, jealousy, and boasting from the candidates, maybe the candidate we didn't support. But for just a second, let's not get overly smug about it, because love also does not rejoice at the wrong, but rejoices in the right. Let's be brutally honest. Some of us, or people you know, were a little bit smug and gleeful when that Access Hollywood tape came out. And others of us were a little bit smug and gleeful when the FBI reopened the investigation. Let's move forward. Because love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. Presidencies too, I suspect. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For our knowledge is imperfect, and our prophecy is imperfect. But when the perfect comes, the imperfect will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child, reasoned like a child. When I matured, I gave up childish ways. And now maybe the most profound piece in this whole essay on love. For now we see in the mirror dimly. And we still see pretty dimly in the mirror of the future. But then we will see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully as I have been fully understood. In other words, presumably there's an information booth in our future. And in the meantime, we have each other, because faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Love abides, so St. Paul proclaims. Presumably, love continues to abide in this country and throughout the world. So also faith and hope. And I want to talk about how faith and hope abide, and then circle back to how love abides more generally, and how love may come to abide in us. These abiding things, in the midst of and maybe even in the face of, the desire for change and the change that occurred. Faith abides. It's a fascinating thing, is faith. It is the concept that revolves around the idea that we believe a bunch of things that we cannot prove. We can, and most of the things that we believe about religion or in the course of our life together in theology are unprovable. And the fact that they're unprovable makes their power in our lives all the more profound. You see, there's a difference between what is provably true and what contains deep truth. I have discussions with my students about this from time to time, about the level to which you can say the Bible is true, factually, historically, inerrantly. And quite honestly, that's pretty limited in how you can say that. And there's a, you know, they teach whole courses in seminaries about biblical inerrancy and about historical critical discussions and all of that. But the distinction I want to draw here in the context of faith abiding is that there is great truth in what is observably impossible to be true. The distinguishing feature of Christianity is Jesus' death and resurrection, and that takes place on Good Friday, and there are four versions of how that story is told in the four Gospels. In three of those versions, Jesus dies on Friday, which is the day of Passover. The fourth Gospel, written by someone attributed to John, takes the day of Jesus' death and time shifts it back 24 hours. Jesus dies on the day of preparation for Passover. They both can't be factually true. Now, why does John do that? Why would he, if we accept that Jesus died on Passover because the three historical versions of it say so, why would John lie to us and shift it back 24 hours? To make a point, to make a larger point about what is truth. You can't work on Passover. It's against Jewish law. You also can't work on the Sabbath. So each Sabbath and each holiday has what's called a day of preparation, where they get ready and they prepare the food. John time shifts Jesus' death back 24 hours to the day of preparation for Passover because it is on the day of preparation that you kill the Passover lambs, making the point that Jesus is the Passover Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. There is enormous truth that inspires an abiding faith, even though it may not be factually true. The things we hold most dear, I think, are the things we can't prove, and we hold them most dear because they are unprovable. Faith abides. So also does hope. And I want to make a crucial distinction here between things I hope for and things I wish for. I wish for lots of things. I wish that lots of other things didn't happen. There's this if only character to wishes. If only this would happen. If only that hadn't happened, etc., etc. Hope is different than that. Hope transcends circumstance. Hope is not if only. Hope is even if we'll figure it out. And we'll find a way to cope. Whether or not the outcome of the election was in keeping with your wishes or mine, I found great hope in one thing that was said. And it was said several different times by several different people in a couple of different ways. And that is this. The hallmark of American democracy, somewhat unique in the entire world, is that the transition of power and authority moves peacefully. We did not have a 95% plurality in the election for one candidate enforced at gunpoint. And there's a lot of places in the world that do. It is the office that matters far more than the person who sits in the chair temporarily. And it is in that that we base our hope, even if. And the circumstances that move forward as a result of this or anything else in our lives, let's expand it to that, our hope is rooted in the reality that we will find a way to cope. Maybe not in keeping with our wishes, But we will move forward. We will engage one another. We will depend on one another to see us through not just an election, but whatever else the future holds for us. And there are things that maybe are more profoundly and personally difficult in our future than just dealing with the events of the last week. Our hope abides because hope transcends circumstance. And it is through circumstance that we learn to cope and that we learn to cope together. Faith abides in its truth. Hope abides in our coping and growing together. And finally, love abides, Paul says, and this is the greatest of all of these things. Love abides, and I think by faith we would say love abides because God is love, and God is, period. So love abides, but the interesting question moving all of us forward is, how does love abide in us? I think we have to let love abide in us. Let love abide. I will tell you candidly that there are people that I deeply love and respect that I suspect voted differently than I did in the election. There are people that I deeply love and respect that I suspect voted just like I did. But I also more profoundly declare that I need their love and respect in my life far more than I need their agreement on anything political. So I don't have to necessarily earn that, but I have to put myself in a position to receive love and respect and then exchange that with the people that love and respect me. And I've made three conscious decisions to change a little bit of how I approach life so that I can put myself in a more clear position to feel the love and respect I so badly need from the people that I love and respect in return. I did one thing right off after Tuesdays. I stopped looking at Facebook. I just stopped looking at it for a while. I asked Jeannie to, if anything's up there cool about the kids, let me know. But I can't right now deal with the dissension. I can't deal with the back and forth lamenting and gloating or whatever else all there. And I don't even know because I just said I'm not going to look at it. The second thing I did, I swore off swearing. Now, that may seem a little odd from your minister, and I will tell you that profane language is not routine in my life, nor, however, is it especially uncommon if you count the words that go through my head that aren't spoken. I have a filter, especially on Sunday morning in a place like this. Less so driving around town by myself in the car. But here's the point, and I'm very serious about this. I've decided to try to consciously avoid the words or retract them in my mind because they express derision. Now, you can disagree with lots of folks about lots of things, and we can have reasoned debates about manners, political, social, religious. What I think has hurt most in the last year and a half is the extent to which discussion and debate instantly becomes derisive. And that's what I think we need to push back from. That's what I think prevents love from abiding in us, and that is the sense of derision. Now, I've dipped my toe into the administrative waters at Texas Tech, and I don't much like it. But I have a lot of meetings with people talking about what to do because so-and-so did this. There's a supervisory component to that. And I will have to tell you that it's not uncommon that that discussion in a committee or just one-on-one with other folks who are dealing with this becomes derisive, you know, and it almost becomes a character assassination of the people involved, and that needs to be dialed back if I or any of us are to put ourselves in position to let love abide. It has to do with language. It has to do with derailing the derision and limiting our discussions to reason, debate, and discussion. So I'm trying consciously to do that. It's the only way I know to push back and, in just a tiny little way, maybe move the tide of derision in the opposite direction. I can at least do that in my own life. So faith abides with the experience of truth, factual or otherwise. Hope abides as it transcends circumstance and as we figure it out together. And love abides in us when we let it. Let love abide. Amen.